Radio 4 presents The Mark Steele Revolution, a series of lectures on revolution. Lecture 1, The French Revolution.
Whole, I don't think we're supposed to like the French Revolution, because usually it's portrayed as this period in French history when for some reason people just couldn't help guillotining each other. People would just invite around their friends and say, "Ah, oh, Henri, Marc Béane, so nice to see you, how are you?" Whoosh! "Henri, I'm so sorry, I have guillotined your wife." And it is true, of course, that the French do seem to have a certain passion that you don't always find in the English. For example, the language. I mean, you can take a simple word like what a cat does when it's happy. We say it purrs, which is so English, isn't it? Because that sort of describes it, but not really. Like, you feed a cat and it jumps on your lap, it doesn't go, purr, does it? Whereas in French, the word is, for the same thing, the word is ronronner. So marvellously expressive. Le chat conduit il ronronne. And in German, the word is probably Katzensnorren. But in truth, most revolutions are fantastic stories, and the characters are extraordinary. We will see in this programme how the French Revolution is probably the best example of how great events are a result of a combination of, on the one hand, these massive shifts in society, which takes centuries to develop, and on the other hand, tiny balls like somebody losing their keys. In the Paris of 1789, work was done by artisans, working in their own room, working for 14 hours a day. Along with anybody else with no wealth, they were known as sans culottes, which meant without breeches, which were only worn by the best of the gentlemen. The ladies had their own title, which was bras nus, which means bare arms, because of the way they worked. And again, this is so French and expressive, isn't it? Why don't we have a similar phrase in English, eau de derrière bras, bare to bars. Most of France, at the time, however, lived in the countryside as peasants. They paid taxes on everything they sold. They had to work one or more days a week on the landlord's estate. They paid tax on almost every item they bought. In fact, the only people in the countryside who were exempt from taxes were the nobility, which meant that the government actually had a way of raising money whereby the poorer you were, the more you paid. Although, at least they didn't have the cheek to put it on Saturday nights on BBC One with Anthea Turner. The king, in theory, had absolute power. He could change the law or raise taxes at any time, as long as, according to custom, he's sitting on his regal cushion, which must have made the royal court like a game of Simon Says.
"I have decided that we should go to war with Brazil. Well, go on. Hurry up. Ah, caught you. I wasn't on the cushion."
But the problem for the king was that it wasn't just the poor who were unhappy at this way of ruling France. Equally impatient was the commercial class. To these people, it made no sense that power should be held by somebody just because they'd been born into it. And their view was Sunder Lane, who wrote at the time,
"The idea of a hereditary landowner makes as much sense as the idea of a hereditary mathematician."
Now, this new ideology went under the name of the Enlightenment and included writers and philosophers like Voltaire and Diderot. Now, for about 70 years, the wealthiest of this class of Frenchmen had been winning influence by buying peerages to become part of nobility. This meant that there were now two sorts of nobles. The first sort, the old type, called nobles of the sword.
"If you care to peruse my family tree, you'll notice that my ancestors have ruled Lyon for over 1,000 years.
And the nouveau riche type, called nobles of robe. "Oi, gorgeous, I'll give you a feather on the roof if you get your robe off the lads." But this change was bound to lead to social conflict.
"Oh, do come in.
Nice pad you got here, mate."
Thank you, yes, it was designed by a personal architect of Louis the 16th.
"Oh, yeah, he done our holiday home in Bordeaux. He's a specialist in mock Louis the 16th period, isn't he?"
No, he doesn't design mock Louis the 16th period. You see, this is the Louis the 16th period.
Yeah, I mean, but we prefer mock. I mean, original stuff's all old and creaky, innit?
Yeah. Listen, you want to try it. It's ever so clever what they can do. I mean, that ancient stuff's always falling to bits, isn't it?
Look, everything currently made in France is genuine Louis the 16th period because Louis the 16th's the current king, you ignorant commoner, unnoble, slave-trading, Le Essex Burke.
I don't need to get the up, mate. I'm only trying to save some money, ain't I? But then the conflict between the two classes reached a new level of crisis because France became bankrupt. After 5 years of funding America's war with the British, they went from having a surplus of 10 million livres to a deficit of 112 million, which was half the entire economy. Taxes were going to have to be raised. So the King was forced to call a meeting of what he called the Estates General. Now, this was made up of delegates representing the three divisions in society: the nobility, who were the first estate, the clergy, who were the second estate, and the third estate, who represented everybody else. The nobility and the clergy were heard by the king in his office, but the third estate were refused entry and only allowed into a spare room, a sort of modern-day equivalent of...
Cherie, darling, Prescott's popping round for a meeting this evening.
Well, we'll make sure he doesn't leave the spare room. He'll make the place stink of chip fat.
Now, the leaders of the third estate, who were mostly lawyers and small businessmen, realised that they were having the noses rubbed into the dirt. And as well as this, they knew they could always be outvoted by the nobles and the clergy combined. So they demanded that the voting process was changed. And they began to meet separately. Until one morning, they arrived at their meeting hall and found that their door was locked, which was the final straw, and they decided to revolt. After all, here was what would become the French Parliament, stood outside a locked hall like Cub Scouts who get to their hut before the bloke with the key arrives. Now, much later on, it turned out that the reason that this hall was locked was just that the caretaker hadn't turned up to unlock them. So, not realising this, the Third Estate adjourned to a nearby tennis court, furious, where they announced that they were setting up their own assembly, which was going to pass laws of its own. And they realised that this was an insurrectory act, and so they pledged an oath to stick together as the new French Parliament. And this was voted for unanimously, except for one person, which is marvellous. Here is this group of people at this historic crossroads in history, and there's one bloke going... Well, I've been with you up to now, but this is just going too far. It's silly. Now, within days of this oath being taken, it was clear that the king was trying to organise another group of 20,000 troops to dispel the new assembly. So the third estate was left with a dilemma. By themselves, they couldn't offer any resistance, firstly because there wasn't enough of them, but also they come from professions that were not really known for their skills in having a bundle. Like, gentlemen's clubs do not very often erupt into shouts of, "Do you want some or not, you slag?" "Oh, leave it, Clarence, he's not worth it." So the only way that they could confront the king was to appeal to the poor. So a meeting was called at the Paris Town Hall, and the electors of the Third Estate called for 200 patriots from each district who were prepared to bear arms. Now, if this meeting was portrayed by Hollywood, it would go,
"Well, looks like the king's made up his mind. There ain't nothing us poor, simple folks gonna do to change it."
"Now, you just listen to me. I'm sick and tired of this fancy king with his highfalutin crown putting up the price of bread and shutting the good folk of this town out of their hall. I see that every district draws up a list of 200 men who are willing to stand up and fight. Well, what are we waiting for?"
"Land sakes, he's right. Let's throw our hats in the air."
In truth, this meeting was probably as chaotic as any mass meeting. There'll have been some people going, "Well, maybe if we just talk to the king politely." And there'll have been some getting over-enthusiastic going, "Here, my brother, he's a builder. Maybe he can knock us up a castle." There'll have been some hippie going, "I'm no good at fighting, but I can play the flute." But following this meeting, thousands of people did come forward. Gunsmiths were raided. Iron workers stayed up all night making pikes. And throughout Paris, people searched for weapons, while defenders of the king were trying desperately to hide them. And on the night before the storming of the Bastille, a man called General Besenval, who was responsible for public order, wrote,
"We hid an armory of muskets in the basement of a hospital, but worried that the mob might still find and steal them. So I employed 20 pensioners to dismantle them. After 6 hours, I discovered that they'd only dismantled one musket each. It seems that a spirit of sedition was rife in the hospital after a legless cripple had introduced into the establishment bundles of subversive songs."
So they'd secured masses of weapons, and as a result, the most effective demonstration in support of the new assembly took place at the Bastille, a prison, which was a symbol of the old regime. So at 10 in the morning, 900 demonstrators marched to the prison, at which point the governor invited two of them in for breakfast. Now, it was announced to the crowd that the reason he'd done this was for talks about handing over the gunpowder that existed in the prison. But this breakfast lasted 3.5 hours. And what I love about this is that throughout all this time, the governor must have been going, What do I do? What do I do? What do I do? Have another quest on. Christ, think of something. Think of something. Maybe they'll all just go away. Maybe they'll just all go away. And, of course, the brilliant thing is you know that amongst those 900 people, there will have been some people going, oh, how much longer? I've got to be at the dentist in half an hour. But then came the crucial intervention of someone who, when he was at school, must have been the mad kid. The way that every class in every school around the world has one mad kid. The kid that when you go on a trip out to the war museum, he goes missing and he turns up dangling upside down from the Statue of Wellington. And that kid became the person who, outside the Bastille, climbed onto a perfume shop and found a way of clambering on to the chains that keep the drawbridge together, and he cuts the chains. And at that moment, the crowd poured in, and so the troops inside the Bastille prison started to fire. During the fighting, 98 demonstrators and 6 troops were killed. So the mob weren't exactly as wild and anarchic as they were made out to be. 98 demonstrators and 6 of the troops. Although, admittedly, they did chop off the governor's head and parade it on a pike. They then went to release the prisoners until they realised that the bloke who'd been given the keys had gone home. So they had to start all over again and batter down the door, at which point they then realised that there were only 7 prisoners inside the Bastille prison. Not only that, but there would have been an 8th one, the Marquis de Sade, but he'd been released a week earlier because he'd been infuriating passers-by by shouting at them through a drainpipe out of the window. They then found out that amongst the 7 prisoners, one of them was convinced he was Julius Caesar. So, you think you've gone through all this, you think at last we've made our way, we've released the prisoners, and then you let them out, and one of them's going, ah, oh, thank you very much. By the way, I came, I saw, I conquered. Now, which one of you's Brutus? Most importantly, though, the king's plan was now in tatters, and July the 14th would be celebrated for at least 208 years as Bastille Day. And that night, the king, in his diary, wrote one word, rien, nothing. Revolutionary Paris became a cauldron of debate in every street. Clubs were set up in every district, pamphlets were discussed and ideas debated all over the town. The king backed down, he withdrew his troops, and he agreed to allow France to be ruled by an elected national assembly to which all men had the vote, although the king still had a veto. Now, one of the most influential groups formed at this time was the Jacobin Club, founded by the debauched Danton and an agitator called Jean-Paul Marat, who was later joined by the lawyer Robespierre. Then the king threw a party at the palace in which, along with his drunken guests, he ceremonially trampled on the red cap of liberty, which had been designed to commemorate the revolution. But there's always gossip after a party. And so all around Paris went the equivalent of,
yeah, you know that king, right? Well, my mate Trish, right, reckons that at this party, right, he was well drunk, right? Well, he's got the cap of liberty, right? Trod all over it and everything. Till it was all torn and dirty.
And then the brilliant thing is the next morning he must have woken up on the floor and gone, oh, there's the cap of liberty. Oh, never did I. But on top of this, rumours were also spreading that the king was again summoning troops to attack Paris. So a group of women, who up until then had been running a campaign to bring down the price of bread, organised a march to retrieve the king from the Versailles Palace and bring him back to Paris where they could keep a check on what he was doing. So, along with the newly formed National Guard, which was the new police force, they went together and they broke into the Versailles Palace grounds. Some of the women were then invited in as a delegation to meet the royal family. And one was apparently so overwhelmed by the beauty and the extravagance of the place that she fainted. So, these women must have been screaming,
capture the king! Capture the king! Oh, what a lovely pair of curtains, Jean.
Despite this, the king was eventually taken back to Paris and made to wear the Cap of Liberty en route, which would be like making Michael Heseltine walk from Henley to Westminster selling copies of Socialist Worker. So the royal family was then moved to the Tuileries in Paris, but they were still plotting on two fronts. Firstly, they were getting messages out to the Spanish and Austrian royalty requesting an invasion to restore their power. And they were plotting to escape, which eventually they did, sneaking away in disguise, but in a stagecoach, which says so much about the character of these people. The most obvious way to draw attention to yourself at this time was to ride around in a stagecoach. It'd be like if there was a revolution in this country and the Queen said, we must escape in disguise. I know, the Royal Yacht Britannia should do nicely. Now, the thing is, they got as far as a staging post at a place called San Menno. But then the son of a village postmaster helped them change horses. And he thought, as he looked inside the stagecoach, that he recognised them. So he chased after them and caught them. And later, he made this statement.
In the coach was a man, and I was struck by the resemblance of his to the likeness of the king printed on a banknote which I had with me at the time. I thought his face was pimply, but my uncle said I must have made a mistake.
Now, both sides did agree, however, on one thing, which was that there was only one way out of this impasse, and that was war. The royalists were still hoping for an invasion that would restore their power, and their opponents, the republicans, now knew that they had to strike against Europe. Because the Europeans clearly weren't happy to have a revolution on their doorstep. For instance, Edmund Burke, writing in England, summed up the European leader's attitude when he called the crowd that stormed the Bastille the swinish multitude. And to support his case, he quoted the Bible, Ecclesiasticus chapter 38.
The wisdom of a learned man cometh by opportunity of leisure, and he that hath little business shall become wise. How can he get wisdom that holdeth the plough, that driveth oxen, and whose talk is only of bullocks?
Now, England, Austria, Spain and Prussia were lining up to attack the regime which gave power to those people whose talk was only of bullocks. The Jacobins realised, though, that to save the revolution, there had to be a second uprising, one that did away with every aspect of the aristocracy's power. And this time, the uprising would be meticulously planned. So on August the 10th, 1792, a battle took place at the Tuileries Garden between the revolutionaries and the royalist Swiss guards, which left the defenders of royalism completely defeated. Every major institution was then placed under the power of the elected assembly, and the royal family was placed in prison. With the king out of the way, his room in the Tuileries was searched. And buried in one of the walls was an iron cupboard which contained letters and papers which proved that the king had been corresponding in secret with France's enemies. Now, had this happened in normal times, it might have gone like this.
Zut alors! Can you believe the king was aiding enemy countries, even allowing arms dealers to supply them with a super gun? We must act swiftly. We must set up an inquiry which takes 3 years to put together and then let him carry on as normal.
But these were revolutionary times, so the outcome was rather different. Then Jean-Paul Marat, by now one of the most influential leaders of the Assembly, received a visitor at his home. Now, at this time, he was still producing Friend of the People and debating with any citizen that came round for an argument. One night, a woman called Charlotte Corday knocked at his door, and she was shown in and asked to wait because he was in the bath, which he had to spend several hours a day lying in because he suffered from the skin disease psoriasis. Now, most modern historians claim that Marat was one of the greatest tyrants of the French Revolution, but you can't imagine modern politicians behaving like this.
Oh, who can that be? Yes?
hello, come to see Mr. Blair. Is he in? Only, I want to talk to him about the minimum wage.
Why, of course, come in. He's in the bath. Go right up.
Who is it, Cherie, darling?
Someone's talked about the minimum wage, darling.
Well, bring him up a cappuccino, darling.
Charlotte Corday, however, was a Girondin who hated the Jacobins. Left unattended, she went upstairs, into the bathroom, and stabbed Marat to death. France then became more polarised than ever. All around France, the sans-culottes took action to defend the revolution and improve their conditions. Grocery stores were invaded throughout Paris by crowds who would demand the lowering of prices. Washerwomen refused to work until there was a decrease in the price of soap. Hairdressers went on strike for the right to set up their own barber shops, which must have been brilliant. This is an official picket line. We're asking you, first of all, not to cross, and then we're asking you off work today, sir, and going anywhere nice on holiday this year, sir? Debate raged everywhere and the aristocracy fled the country. The Duchess of Gontaut, for example, wrote about her escape.
I had a painful surprise on seeing among the crowd my wet nurse. Her ingratitude was such that she added an obscene gesture, which I shall not describe.
But even the mass fleeing of the aristocracy added to the demands, because then wig makers started demonstrating for unemployment benefit because there was nobody left who wanted a wig. This extraordinary flurry of activity from every quarter led to a third mass uprising, this time one which put the Jacobins in charge of the Assembly, and at that point began the most radical year of the revolution. Spurred on by all that had happened, the Jacobins imposed a maximum price for bread. Plans were made for the first ever welfare state. Payments were made to the relatives of injured soldiers. A national plan was drawn up for comprehensive education. And as far as I know, Robespierre was not caught sending his own son to a selective school in Hammersmith. Full citizenship was granted for the first time for Jews. The Catholic Church, which was associated so closely with the old regime, was replaced by a thing called the Cult of the Supreme Being. The Lord's Prayer was changed so that it read,
Our Father, who art in heaven, from whence you protect in such an admirable manner the French Republic and the sans-culottes, your most ardent defenders, give us today this daily bread, which we eat despite the vain efforts of Pitt, Coburg, and all the tyrants united to keep us hungry.
A new calendar based on science was introduced, in which there were 10 days in a week, and the months were named after the weather that you'd expect in them. And again, if you think that's dull, you've got to remember this is French. So, for instance, one of the spring months became Brumaire, month of mist. Whereas, if it had been English, we'd have called it, oh, it's still a bit chilly, isn't it, dear month? And July became Thermidor, month of heat. Although we would have called that, of course, I'm only looking totty in a park month. Slavery in the colonies was abolished. Weights and measures were unified into the metric system that's used today. Paris was divided into the electoral districts that still apply today. In fact, there had been greater social change in those 3 years than in the previous 500. And yet, hand in hand with that change went the terror. And as I said at the beginning, more than anything else, the image of the French Revolution is the image of the terror.
Oh, marvellous. Now, what's this next one up for?
Oh, I don't know. Have a look in the programme.
Ah, yeah, sneezing in an aristocratic manner.
Hot dogs, popcorn, knitting needles.
Now, what about this next one?
Yeah, he was looking at Danton's bird.
Oh, hang on, he's making a speech.
It's a far, far better thing.
Oh, shut up. Get on with it.
So what was the terror? How was a handful of crazed madmen able to stroll through France chopping off people's heads? If a few of us now decided to just draw up a list of people and go out chopping off people's heads, we'd be stopped very quickly by the majority of people who wouldn't agree with it. Unless, of course, we started with that stupid bloke with the sideburns who does the horse racing. So the terror must have had support, but why? Well, partly because it was used against the rich, who, to get round the maximum price law, had been hoarding bread and selling it on the black market. And because the terror organised the army to go into the countryside to force farmers to release corn into the cities, which they'd also been hoarding. Now, as a result, during the period of Jacobin rule that had the heaviest use of the guillotine, there were about 2,500 executions in Paris. After the Jacobins were overthrown in 1794, there were far greater numbers killed, and the end of controls on prices created this famine, which was described by one writer.
The mothers of Caen in 1795 were allaying the cries of their newborn children with rags dipped in water. That way they did not take long to die. Better than watching one's children grow too feeble to cry.
But there are two other points which should be made about the guillotine. First of all, it was created by a man called Dr. Guillotine as a humane method of execution, because before the guillotine, victims were hung or strapped to a water wheel until their back broke. So the thing is that when Dr. Guillotine invented his machine, there will have been, at the time, a French Michael Howard going, "Doesn't this prove that the Jacobins are soft on crime?" "But Mr. Robespierre doesn't care, because he's the burglar's friend." And there would have been someone down the pub going, "Them bloody guillotines are on holiday camp." But lastly, who do you think, in the middle of all this, had the audacity to demand a pay rise? But a man called Sanson, who was the chief guillotiner. But the Jacobins were falling apart. Danton was now campaigning for an end to the war. And so he was arrested by his colleagues, found guilty of treason and executed. And then the French armies captured Belgium and beat the British, the Dutch and the Austrians. Now, ironically, this hastened the Jacobins' downfall, because now that the threat of a royalist invasion was gone, those businessmen who up until now had tolerated the Jacobins, they had no need to carry on supporting their radicalism or their terror. On the 9th of Thermidor, Robespierre and the other Jacobin leaders were arrested at the assembly, except for one. A man called Philippe Lebas, who got up and shouted, "What about me? I demand to be arrested along with my colleagues." An act of extraordinary courage and fantastically honourable. But what a pillock. By the next day, they had all been executed, and the revolution, which had gone along this extraordinary path of radicalism for 5 years, started to go back the other way. The new government called itself the Directory, and bit by bit ditched most of the Jacobins' changes, until they were in turn ousted by a committee which included Napoleon, who then staged a coup to become emperor. So what can we conclude from all this? Well, didn't it all end up back where it started? A man called Su Onlay, who was one of Mao Zedong's ministers, when he was asked about the effects of the French Revolution, said, "It's too early to tell." And maybe he's right. But there are some things that are clearly here because of it. The egalitarianism of the revolution, of course, was ditched. But the values of business over nobility stayed. France did become a nation. The tolls and tariffs never returned, nor did slavery, nor did the feudal taxes. Universities were built, and science valued over mysticism. These changes were brought about partly because of the massive shifts in society, but they could never have happened without the tiny actions of people who could never have guessed they would have any influence on anything. Because who can say whether the revolution would have happened if the caretaker had got up on time? Or if nobody had climbed up to the perfume shop roof? Or if that boy hadn't recognised the king? And finally, the French Revolution did have an effect because it made life inconsolably miserable for anybody born in Hartlepool. Because during the Napoleonic Wars that followed, the French were depicted in the English press as monkeys. So when a shipwrecked boat landed off the coast of Hartlepool at the time, with nobody on board except for a monkey, the people of Hartlepool thought that this monkey was a Frenchman. So they tried the monkey, and they hung it. And that is all that anybody knows about Hartlepool. Especially if you go round the northeast and you mention Hartlepool, all they know about is that they hung the monkey. So as a result of the French Revolution, there could one day be a scientist from Hartlepool who comes up with a cure for all known diseases, and who'll be stood there at the press conference about to announce this extraordinary breakthrough, and there'll be somebody at the back going, "Oi, Hartlepool man, you hung that bloody monkey!"
The Mark Steele Revolution was written and presented by Mark Steele with the help of Martin Heider and Carla Mendonca. The broadcast assistant was Alison Harbert, and the producer was Phil Clark.